Chapter 2.
If you can't beat them, divide them.
Cal Omis, Chief of State, Galactic Alliance. Office of the Chief of State, Senate Building, Coruscant.
Not exactly our finest hour, Admiral.
Chief of State Cal Omis looked a much older man than he'd been just a few months earlier. Chani Othel prided herself on a decent understanding of human facial expressions and the telltale little signs of fatigue and stress. Omis had them all. Fluid-filled bulges under his watery blue eyes, a peppering of reddish spots on his chin, and a sour smell of calf when she got too close to him. But mainly, it was the eyes. Human eyes told her everything she needed to know. When she glanced at Jason Solo, he was a model of confidence and composure, except for his eyes. There were no signs of poor health, but he was far from the glacially calm facade he presented. She could see the changes in the pupils of his dark eyes. Small, almost imperceptible, but his pupils flickered, showing that some things got to him. That was useful to know.
"We didn't lose the battle at Gilater 8,
she said.
"Whatever the Confederation claims.
We didn't win it, either, said Omis.
He'd developed a habit of moving sheets of flimsy around his desk. He didn't need hard copy records, but it seemed to give him some comfort to handle them, as if they were the last tangible grip he had on his own government.
Consider this a wash-up.
We've had our wash-up, Jason said. We know what went wrong and why we fell for a trap.
Poor intel, said Omis. As a Jedi, do you not sense these ambushes?
Neothel noted Jason's three rapid blinks. There was little love lost between the two men now. That remark really stung Jason for some reason, even though he was far too smart to delude himself with ideas of omniscience.
"We're neither invincible nor infallible," he said softly.
That was when he was at his most lethal, when he sounded quietly reasonable.
"I had unreliable intelligence, and that's an occupational hazard. The fact that we got out in one piece is largely due to Jedi skills. Ironically, my parents' and my uncle's skills."
"Don't mind me, Jason, or the fleet. You're too modest, Colonel Solo," she said. "I hear you fought quite remarkably."
Jason let the comment pass without reply, or a self-effacing half-smile, which was his usual response. Omis flicked the controls of the holoscreen set in his office wall. A fly-through image of a planet resolved into a cityscape. Hololinks showed inset 3D images of explosions and smoking skylines.
"Now we have reports of fighting breaking out on Repoblas."
"Why?" Jason asked. "Nobody in the Sepan system has any interest in the Confederation. I've had no intelligence—"
"They don't need any love for either cause," said Neothel. "We've reached the free-for-all stage. What better time than during a civil war to resurrect their dispute with Dymok? Like a cantina brawl. One fight breaks out, and suddenly everyone remembers they have a score to settle."
"There'll be plenty more Me Too conflicts," Omis sighed. "And we have to ask where we draw the line."
Jason looked as if he was studying the schematic of Repoblus's capital. Neothel judged that he was actually fretting about the limited scope of his intelligence.
"Chief of State," Even the Empire never managed to stop the Sepan Wars, and it was prepared to take far more extreme measures than we are,
she said.
We should resist any pressure to get involved. We're getting perilously close to overstretch.
Omis changed the hollow image to a tote board of the Senate composition. The names of most of the member planets were listed in red, but some were in blue. There were more blue names than she remembered from the last time she'd seen this list.
Two more members seceded last night, Omis said. Las Lagan and Beris. Minor worlds, but let's do the arithmetic. The more planets that secede from the GA, the fewer military assets I have to call on, and the more assets there are that are potentially available to the Confederation.
Jason was a master of expressionless contempt.
I think I can work that out, yes.
And you still believe in responding with maximum force, within the boundaries of ethical treaties?
Yes.
Then we're on the downward spiral.
Omis walked into the center of the room and gave Neophil a glance that verged on pleading.
Come on, you're the military. You know this is true. Sooner or later, secessions reach a point where the GA becomes the rump, where the Confederation equals and then outnumbers us.
Omis held up two fingers and counted off theatrically.
Problem one, we would be outgunned. Problem two, where's our legitimacy? What peace would we be enforcing?
Neathel decided to let Jason respond and keep her powder dry. Omis had an excellent point, but it was a politician's point, not a chief of staff's. Her job at that moment was to decide how to use force to achieve Omis's objectives, not to define what those objectives should be. That was a battle for Jason Solo. She watched.
In that case,
Jason said, so softly that it was almost a whisper,
they can defeat us without a shot being fired. They can break us with a sheet of flimsy. I'd call that surrender.
I'd call it wargaming the worst scenario.
Omis looked to Neophil again.
And you, Admiral, will know when we reach the military tipping point.
Neophil had two strategies. One with all the GA pieces she had in play at the current time, and one with Coruscant-based forces alone. It made sense to work on the basis of the latter if support was falling away. She glanced at the list of red names and the growing tally of blue ones while keeping an eye on Jason. Humans always had a hard time working out where Mon Calamari were looking, and realized that the graph wouldn't be a straight line. If there was to be an erosion of the alliance, it wouldn't be a tidy progression. It would be a sudden collapse.
That point hasn't come,
she said at last.
I'll let you know as soon as I start getting nervous. But I can tell you that we're already overstretched because of the geography. Multiple fronts. Not good.
And if we withdraw support from the Allies, then we magnify the problem, Omis said. They'll switch.
Jason inhaled audibly.
This is why I advocated going in very hard and very fast in the first place.
Omis smiled, but without humor.
Ah, I told you so. I wondered how long it would be before we reached that stage.
Chief Omis,
I know hindsight gets us nowhere now, but we might as well be honest with each other and recognize what we can each contribute.
Neophil was working through her phases of Jason. First, he'd been a useful ally, then an instrument for getting the tougher decisions past Omis. He was still good for the Alliance, she thought, but he was far more the politician than the soldier lately. His language had changed, less direct, more circumspect. She longed for plain talking. But she wasn't doing any in front of Jason now.
My sources tell me the Corellians failed to recruit the Mandalorians fairly early on, she said. For some obscure reason, they appear to be staying neutral. Unless they've had some collective lobotomy. I call that interesting.
Omis looked at Jason pointedly, hands in pockets.
Have we approached them? Have any of your shadowy little operatives signed some of them up? They were pretty handy during the last war, as I recall.
Jason looked serene, except for his pupils.
No, and I suspect we wouldn't receive a positive response.
Why? Don't tell me they've discovered pacifism after millennia of pillaging and destroying. They're congenital thugs. Any excuse for a fight that they can get paid for.
You think I don't know what you did, Jason?
Neophil feigned mild interest.
But word gets around. Let's see if you play this straight.
Jason was completely still, except for the fact that he meshed his fingers in his lap. It looked like a meditation pose, utterly at odds with his black Galactic Alliance Guard coveralls.
There's the small matter of the fact that I lost Boba Fett's daughter during an interrogation, he said.
Aha! Lost?
Omis blinked a few times.
What exactly is lost?
She died while I was interrogating her. I had no idea who she was at the time.
Omis looked stunned for a moment, but then let out a small involuntary
ha
of oddly horrified amusement.
And Fett knows this?
Jason's face was as calm and impenetrable as a statue's.
He does now.
Then I imagine you'll be looking over your shoulder for the rest of your life, Colonel.
Jason looked as if he hadn't thought about that. His composure wobbled for a second as he rearranged his clasped hands.
Asking him for a favor wouldn't be the smartest thing to do.
No. Neophil wondered if Jason had finally bitten off more than he could chew. Gossip reached her ears, and gossip from Jason's secret police was a wholly different and much more reliable source than the murmurings in the pleakwood-paneled Senate corridors. But it didn't suit her plans to have Jason crash and burn, and she didn't have to like people to work with them.
I've arranged to meet the ambassadors from Las Lagan and Barriss with the diplomatic corps later today, said Omis. Let's see if we can talk them back inside the fold. I don't want to start a stampede.
What's their problem?
Asked Neophil.
Unwilling to commit troops.
Give them a waiver.
And what kind of message does that send to Corellia? That's backpedaling.
Omis seemed indignant.
That's why we went to war in the first place. The principle of pooled defensive capability for the Alliance.
Las Lagan and Barriss between them contribute 20,000 troops, tops. The diplomatic benefit strikes me as outweighing both the principle and any use they might be.
The worst thing in the world, Neophil decided, was a politician who discovered scrupulous principle halfway through the game.
They're badly trained and poorly equipped, so I don't think I'll miss their military input to the GA.
Jason eased himself out of his chair and stood up, making it clear he was heading for the door.
Well, at least there's some positive news on the counterterrorism front. It's the second month running that arms seizures are up. We're shutting down their supply routes.
Are you certain they're all politically motivated, and not just criminals?
Omis asked.
If you were shot by one of them, Jason said, would you care about that fine distinction? Ordinary crime and terror tend to become bedfellows sooner or later. And ask Coruscant Security Force for their latest violent crime statistics. It's becoming a lot quieter all around.
He gave them both a polite nod and left. Omis watched the doors close behind him, and then wandered over to the main window overlooking the plaza to stare out in calculated silence.
What have we come to, Admiral? That my first thought on hearing that Colonel Solo kills a prisoner is that he might now have enemies big enough to keep him off my back.
It was a blisteringly frank admission.
You're only human, she said.
Omis didn't see the other side of that verbal coin.
It's an indictment of what we've all become. That my inner circle of advisors isn't the security or justice secretary, or even diplomats, but the chief of staff and the head of the secret police.
Omis began his ritual amble around the office, leaving faint and short-lived footprints in the pale blue pile of the carpet.
I think about that, you know. I wonder how a colonel rises to be so influential. And I really don't know if I let it happen because he's a Jedi, or because he's G.A.G.
Neophil thought it was smart of Omis to keep the real discussions to a handful of people who could be trusted not to shift allegiance to Corellia. There was no telling with some senators.
In these uncertain times, it's necessary. We can convene all the emergency committees we like, but the conduct of the war is a matter for very few. The war beyond our boundaries, and the war within them.
Do you think we still have a war within?
Enough Coruscanti think we do. There's no such thing as only thousands dying in terror attacks. Lose a ship with thousands of crew, and civilians say that's too bad. That's what they signed up for. Lose a few civilians, and it's a planetary tragedy.
The GAG had smashed most of the terror networks in a matter of months. They were very efficient at tracking down funding and establishing links. But they were still active, and kicking down different doors now. Boffin, Confederation sympathizers, and a few people who just breached the peace while emergency powers were in force.
It's as valid to deal with the fear of terrorism as with the reality.
Omis paused to try to look her in the eye.
Admiral, you strike me as an officer raised in the traditions of decency, honor, the rule of law. That goes out the window all too often in trying times.
I stick to what I'm tasked to do, and I'm grateful I don't have to get involved in GAG business.
Omis appeared to note the ambivalence.
Nominally, the GAG is under your command.
Nominally. You feel Colonel Solo is exceeding his boundaries, and that I should apply them a little more emphatically.
I'm concerned about his operating procedures with suspects. I'll admit that.
What do you want? for me to admit I'm concerned, too.
Are you?
Sometimes.
Omis's brows lifted in a split second of hope.
I appreciate that it's not easy to curb an officer who does so much to reassure the public.
We all need heroes in difficult times, even if we don't need their protection as much as we think.
Indeed. And for all their muttering, I do believe the Jedi Council secretly relishes seeing one of their own kind adored for his two-fisted and muscular approach to keeping the peace. It dispels the image of their being passive mystics, out of touch with grim reality.
Success is everyone's child. Failure is an orphan.
Omis smiled ruefully.
Well, he'll either win the war for us, or bring us down.
He went back to his polished plane of a desk, looking somewhat shrunken when he sat behind it now. The small bronzium vase holding a single purple kibo bloom made the desk look all the more vast and empty.
Heroes have a habit of doing that.
Us bring us down.
And politicians had a habit of sowing doubts and ideas that wormed into the subconscious. Neothel noted Omis's subtle warning, and almost began to explain that she already had the required degree of paranoia for a more political career, but he probably knew that by now. If he didn't, she was slipping.
"I'll bear that in mind," she said.
Omis was a consummate statesbeing, who'd survived attempts on his life and his career several times. He'd understand the entire conversation that was packed into that one line. That she knew Jason was a loose cannon. That she knew he was massively, overwhelmingly ambitious. And that she knew she might find herself sidelined by him if she didn't keep on her toes. And that she knew Omis was aware that her eyes were on his job, and that he might make that accession easier for her one day if she worked with him rather than with Jason Solo.
Us.
Political code was a very economical way of imparting delicate information without actually using incriminating words. It saved a lot of time and trouble. Neothel took the silence as a cue that the meeting was over. As the doors closed behind her, she glanced back at Omis. Her last glimpse was one of a man who shut his eyes for a second, as if completely exhausted.
He'll strut back into the Senate in a couple of hours, as if everything's under control. Do I really want a job like that?
She still thought she did. She had lunch in one of the Senate's many eateries. There was always at least one tap caf or restaurant open at any time of the day or night. Some of them relaxed, some of them formal. All of them hotbeds of gossip, debate, and deal-making. More government business went on in these places than ever transpired in the Senate chamber. They were also relatively safe places to talk to beings who might attract attention if she met them at the officers' club. Hiding in plain sight worked remarkably well now, and nobody took much notice of the fact that she happened to be grabbing a snack at the same table as a gossam called Gafal Keb, a senior civil servant in the Public Protection Department. Their voices were drowned in the general chatter. They referred to Jason as the new boy, the GAG as the club. Omis became, inevitably, the boss. It was unoriginal, but for ears attuned to picking out names from across the room, it seized no attention.
"Is the new boy under any threat from our boisterous friends in Keldabe?"
she asked.
"Not a word coming out of there."
Keb had a way of slowly taking in everything around him, 360 degrees.
"But if they were planning anything, they wouldn't tell CSF.
Word is that Shevu is seriously hacked off with his way of doing business, too.
Shevu is very old-fashioned about losing prisoners. Anyone else in the club unhappy with the management?
Oddly, no. The new boy's willingness to lead from the front does breed loyalty, I admit.
Who's he spying on now?
Not you, as far as I can tell. I'd be very surprised if he wasn't keeping an unauthorized eye on the boss. But I don't have any hard evidence yet. The club's good at covering its tracks, as you'd expect.
Anything else I ought to be aware of?
Minor procurement issues, but that's nothing to do with the new boy.
How minor?
Griping in the mess about substandard kit and difficult shortages at the moment. You might want to kick a few data pushers before it turns into a problem.
I'll have someone look at it.
It would keep Jason occupied. He cared about troop welfare.
Matters like kit seem to hit morale hardest.
It was a brief conversation. Two GA personnel who had every reason to be exchanging a few words. Nobody took any notice. The Supreme Commander and senior domestic security staff talked all the time. Nobody knew that the three individuals who were running the war dared not turn their backs on one another. That was politics. Admiral Cha Niathal was determined to get used to it. Star System M2X32905, near Bimiel. There was a presence following her, and Lumia could pick it out like a beacon even at this range. So could the meditation sphere.
Broken, said the ship.
In the back of her mind, the presence manifested as a jagged, shattered mass of black and white glass. If she concentrated on it long enough, it resolved into a whole vessel again, but the cracks were still visible.
It's broken, all right, Lumia said. What shall we do? Allow it to catch up? Or shall we see how good a hunter it is?
The meditation sphere felt elated. The smoldering red flame that seemed embedded in its bulkheads grew brighter and more golden, and Lumia felt a conspiratorial sense of humor flood her. The ship was enjoying itself. Of course, it had been dormant on Zeost for untold years, a conscious thing waiting for purpose and interaction. Nothing in the galaxy enjoyed being alone, be it flesh or metal. Lumia rocked back on her heels, still a little disoriented by a cockpit that didn't wrap around her. It didn't feel like an extension of her body, as a starfighter did. Instead of neatly arranged screens and controls within her reach, there was nothing except stark, grainy, stone-like surfaces in which images appeared and then vanished again. The ship's bulkhead showed her a pattern of lights. A small craft matched their course at a range of 5,000 kilometers. The asteroid belt, where her base was hidden, appeared as a sprinkling of stars on a dark blue ground, as if a hole had been punched in the bulkhead, and she almost expected to feel air rushing past as the vacuum beyond claimed her.
"Time to jump," she said.
The meditation sphere felt as if it took a deep breath and lunged forward. There was no inertia, no sensation of movement whatsoever, and yet Lumia was sure her stomach leapt and her head spun with the acceleration. The tracking screen was gone. She was looking at the streaming lights of stars, and then velvet blackness, unlit except for random pinprick flares. She could see beyond the ship. It was as if it weren't there. She knew where she was. She could feel the pursuing vessel dwindling to nothing behind her, and the transparasteel shattering into broken chaos again. For a moment she felt panic. For a moment, she was in a stricken TIE fighter, struggling for life. Broken, fired upon by Luke Skywalker, certain she'd die. Instantly, the bulkheads became red-hot pumice again. She jerked back to the present.
"You're safe," the ship said.
It felt almost guilty for alarming her. She wanted to reassure it.
"Just a memory," she thought. "Nothing to concern you."
And it seemed reassured. Nobody, nothing, had cared about her welfare for a very long time. Not since she'd been in Imperial training. Luke Skywalker's brief affection didn't count.
"The broken pursuer has jumped, too," said the ship.
"Try not to outrun it too far."
Lumia searched herself for regret and loneliness, and found none. It was still good to find a sense of kinship with another intelligence.
"We don't want it to lose us."
"It is still following us," said the ship.
"What did you think of your last pilot?" Lumia asked.
"Not like us."
"Not Sith material, then?"
"No."
The ship knew Ben wasn't fit to be Jason's apprentice.
"Less like us than the one who follows."
The meditation sphere dropped out of hyperspace and made convincing speed for the asteroid. Lumia gave it a mental image of marking time until the pilot on their tail had located them again, and then showed it her habitat on the asteroid. They prepared to dock, Lumia and the ship, somehow one mind for brief moments. Ben had proven he wasn't the right apprentice for Jason. For all his fierce courage on Zeost, the boy had still succumbed to a sentimental Jedi urge and risked his life to rescue that child. He lacked the ruthless edge a Sith needed. But at least he had done something right. Without him, she wouldn't have this rare vessel. It would be instrumental in Jason's future. She could see it in the Force. Somehow her own future wasn't linked with it, but she'd look after it until the time came to relinquish control.
"Ben."
She bore the boy no ill will, but he was simply surplus to requirements now.
"Is it him, though? Is this who Jason has to kill?"
Perhaps the Force had spared Ben from her plot for a reason. Perhaps it was his destiny to help his master by sacrificing his life. And so it wasn't Lumia's to take.
"I don't know what Jason has to do. I just don't know. I can't see the bridge he has to cross to become the Sith Lord he's destined to be."
Did Jason believe that she had no more answers to that question than he did? She doubted it. He had to immortalize his love, to kill it, to destroy what he loved most. As the meditation sphere slipped into the docking bay of her habitat, Lumia pondered on what Jason Solo loved and couldn't bear to lose, the sacrifice that would take him beyond the mundane world and into greatness. His sister, Jaina? No, he'd already tried to have her court-martialed. His parents? He'd ordered their arrest. But punishment was one thing, and killing was another.
"Home," said the ship. "I can defend you against the one who follows."
"Thank you."
Lumia was taken aback.
"It's not necessary. Let the other ship land."
Would it be Ben Skywalker? The boy was the nearest Lumia had seen to someone Jason loved. He wanted Ben to succeed. He ignored the weakness in the boy. Luke Skywalker? No. Jason cared nothing for Luke, and perhaps even despised him. Mara? She might have been the last person to stand by Jason, but he had less feeling for her than for his own parents. Ben, then. It was almost certainly Ben. Or maybe it wasn't a person. Maybe he had to kill an organization or something abstract. Perhaps he didn't have to kill anything at all. Lumia fought impatience. Whatever Jason's destiny might be, whatever pivotal act he had to perform, it would be soon. She could almost feel the fabric of the Force anticipating it.
And perhaps it's going to be me he kills.
But she was Sith, and any Sith would expect that of her pupil. It was a price she had to be ready to pay. Very broken, said the ship, snapping her out of her thoughts. Lumia got to her feet and stood in front of the bulkhead. The glowing pumice thinned to transparency, but it wasn't a visual illusion. The bulkhead opened to the atmosphere, and a ramp formed from the ship's casing. When Lumia walked down it into the hangar area, an old Conqueror assault vessel was edging through the airlocks. She hadn't seen one of the figure-eight-shaped ships in a long time. The hatch popped, and someone emerged, partly swathed in a cloak, but with a distinctive limping gait.
"You take your risks, Dancer."
Lumia was beginning to find Alim Arar a liability.
"I might have fired on you."
The Twi'lek threw the cloak back from her face and tilted her head. It was the practiced pose of a woman who had spent so much of her life being coquettish that it had become unconscious habit. She had been used to male attention, and still behaved as if she deserved it, even if there were no males around, and even if her looks had been ruined by lightsaber wounds. The severed stump of her leku gave her a grotesquely comic look. But Alima wasn't a laughing matter at all. She was, as the ship put it, broken. This was a damaged, vengeful creature that wanted to lash out, and Lumia had no patience with lack of discipline. Alima was also insane, and a dark Jedi with those problems was a very dangerous complication.
"But you didn't."
The Twi'lek's eyes were on the meditation sphere.
"We find this ship interesting." "I thought you might."
Lumia indicated the doors leading to her chambers. Home wasn't the word.
"Seeing as you're here, you might as well come in."
Alima prowled around the ship, gazing at it from all angles, clearly fascinated.
"It thinks," she said. "This ship thinks." "Thinking's useful. Try it sometime."
Lumia knew she ought to handle a madwoman more carefully, but she was short on tolerance today. She strained to sense what the ship might be saying, but all she could detect was its watchfulness, its sensors taking a wary interest in Alima. It could probably taste her darkness.
"What brings you here?"
"We have been tracking the Anakin Solo. We have considered Jason Solo's attitude to his parents, and we think we might gain access to Han and Leia Solo by working with Jason."
Alima put a caressing hand on the meditation sphere, and Lumia felt it flinch, then somehow soften. It knew Alima was damaged. Its duty was to aid, to take care of its pilot. That tendency seemed to make it oddly sympathetic to those in need of assistance. Lumia sighed to herself. That was the last thing she needed, a Sith vessel that felt sorry for a crazy Twi'lek trollop. She sent the ship a sharp image of Alima, face twisted with psychotic rage, crashing the sphere into a jagged mountain. The ship got the idea right away. Alima pulled back as if burned.
"It would be helpful for all of us," Lumia said carefully, "if you avoided crossing Jason Solo's path at the moment. There's a war on, you know.
We have our task, and you have yours. Ours is to have balance for what the Solos did to us. Leia will still be trying to bring her precious son back to the light, and that means he remains good bait for our purposes.
Let me put it another way,
Lumia said kindly, steering her toward the doors.
Get in my way, and I'll kill you.
Alima gave her a curious, lopsided smile, but allowed herself to be ushered into the living quarters.
Do you know who you're dealing with?
Alima asked. Lumia probed Alima's presence again. It felt like shards of broken glass in her mouth, as alien as any being she'd ever encountered. She'd been in the minds of the insane before, but never a Jedi, and never one this deluded. It was almost frightening. It was the sense of us that was most disturbing. She found it hard to pick her way between the hive-mind elements and the fragmented personality of one being.
Yes, I do, Lumia said. And I'll still kill you if you let this feud ruin bigger strategies. There'll be time for you to have your revenge later. Interfere with my plans, and I'll kill the Solos myself, and then you'll never have your balance.
Lumia lowered her voice to a soothing whisper.
And you know I can do that, don't you?
Seemingly unperturbed, Alima gazed around Lumia's quarters. They were sparsely furnished now, because she'd taken most of her necessary possessions back to the safe house on Coruscant, or the latest address anyway, except for duplicates of the equipment she kept to maintain her cybernetic prosthetics, and basic essentials for a brief stay. Alima had the look of someone sizing up an apartment and deciding whether to buy it.
No, you can't stay here, said Lumia.
Telepathy was beyond her, but she knew a proprietorial look when she saw it. It made sense to keep an eye on Alima. She was so fixated and reckless that she might, just might, put a hydrospanner in the works. And that wasn't something Lumia was prepared to risk. The stakes were too high, the moment too close.
If I had any sense, I'd kill her now before she becomes too much trouble. But
Alima still had her uses, until her madness became too unmanageable.
You understand revenge, said Alima.
She settled on a sofa, one arm conspicuously limp, and a petulant frown creased her brow for a moment.
Luke Skywalker destroyed your life. He left you scarred, too.
Oh, much more than scarred.
Lumia pulled her veil from her face and let Alima see the damage to her jaw. Then she placed one boot on a chair, took out a vibroblade, and rammed it into her thigh. There was a metallic scrape. Alima's expression was suitably surprised.
I'm actually more machine than organic.
Lumia went on.
There's a point, I think, at which a woman ceases to be human with cybernetic implants and becomes a machine with organic parts. I believe I've passed that threshold. And you know what? I'm not unhappy with that.
You want to punish Luke, as we want to punish Leia.
Lumia leaned over Alima and caught her by her collar, jerking her face close to hers so she couldn't look away.
Luke seems to think that too, which I find staggeringly arrogant.
Was that a little fear in Alima's eyes? Sometimes it was interesting to play the madwoman herself.
The galaxy revolves around him, he thinks. But then many men think that way. No, I don't miss my beauty, you fool, because it would have vanished by now anyway.
Once I understood that my injuries freed me from worrying about such trivia, I realized I had a task that only I could fulfill.
She tightened her grip on the flimsy fabric at Alima's throat.
And that task is close to completion. So if you thwart me in any way, I'll become very focused on you. Do you understand?
For a moment, Alima lost that oddly demented expression and looked like a normal, sane person in fear of her life. Lumia wasn't sure what she looked like herself at that moment, but it seemed to work.
"We will respect your wishes,"
Alima said imperiously. Lumia decided not to backhand her, but it took an effort. She didn't have time for this nonsense.
"Do yourself a favor,"
she said, and let Alima's collar slide out of her grasp with a hiss of sheer fabric over her gloves.
"Ask yourself what you have against Leia Solo, other than the fact that she made you ugly. If there's nothing beyond that, then your quest for balance is a waste of time."
Alima blinked as if she'd been slapped. Maybe it was the first time anyone had used the word ugly to her. She wasn't. She wasn't anything. In a galaxy of vastly diverse life forms, Lumia had ceased to be able to judge appeal, or even want to. It was fascinating how the once beautiful fared so much worse than lesser mortals when age and disfigurement overtook them. It was all illusion. The millions of species in the galaxy couldn't agree on what constituted beauty anyway. But Alima looked as if she was thinking it over.
"We still wish to help you achieve your objective."
"Good," said Lumia.
The way Alima used "we" gnawed away at her patience for some reason. She knew it was a hive-mind remnant of her joiner days, but it irked her.
"Because if hurting Leia is what you want most, letting Jason get on with what he has to do is going to hurt her most of all."
"Do you want to hurt Leia?"
"She's done nothing to me. I have no feelings either way. There might be something you can do to help me. Something you do better than anyone." "Appeal to her vanity. It's big enough. Keep tabs on Jason for me. Covert observation."
"We will. But can you not locate him any time you want?"
"Not closely enough."
Lumia didn't have the complete Sith ability to see all the pieces in the game, every element in the battle. That was for a full Sith master. But she didn't need to let on that she had fewer powers than Alima might think.
"I don't have time to log his movements, but for his own safety I need to know exactly where he is at all times, especially when he leaves Coruscant. Do you think you can do that? It's tedious work, but necessary."
"We can."
"And lose the Conqueror. I'll find you a less conspicuous ship."
"The Orange Sphere?"
"No."
Alima seemed to have taken a fancy to the Sith vessel. Perhaps it was because she could communicate with it. Once Lumia penetrated the jagged chaos in her mind, there was a sense of isolation in the Twi'lek that made her recoil.
"Something more suitable. And cover your tracks when you leave. Don't lead anyone back to this asteroid."
"Our expertise is surveillance and assassination,"
Alima said stiffly.
"We aren't an amateur."
Lumia took her through the winding passages that honeycombed the asteroid and brought her to the emergency access. Even in space, she thought of it as the back door, where a few small ships were standing idle. Once she'd had a battle fleet, but it was long gone in the Yuuzhan Vong War. Her needs were different now, anyway. She needed stealth, not firepower.
There.
She pointed Alima to a decidedly scruffy shuttle, the kind that priority couriers used to ferry urgent consignments between worlds. It was 15 meters long, and a third of that was now given over to a hyperdrive and discrete armaments. A courier shuttle needed to be fast and able to defend itself against piracy, but this one had considerably more than the standard specifications. Lumia waited for Alima to complain about it.
"We won't be noticed in this,"
the Twi'lek said, appearing satisfied.
"You can change the identification transponder and the livery panel to any of 100 courier companies."
That configuration was actually standard, but Lumia had added a few bogus and untraceable companies for good measure.
"It's not luxurious, but it does the job."
Alima lifted the hatch. It sprung away from the casing to form an awning. She peered inside.
"She took everything from us."
Her voice was muffled by the hatchway. Then she pulled out again.
"We're alone. She's made us solitary."
"Oh, give me strength. She's rambling again. Who did?"
"Leia Solo. She took our Leku, and so we can't communicate fully with others. She caused the destruction of our nest, too. And she took what attracted others to us. Our beauty."
Alima had been thinking then. She'd chewed over Lumia's challenge and worked out what really drove her.
"We're lonely, and we can never touch the world properly again."
Lumia had been trained never to drop her guard, and pity wasn't something she was accustomed to feeling. She didn't quite feel pity for Alima, but she did get a sudden and painful glimpse of her loss, and it must have been a particularly agonizing one for a Twi'lek. Without both Leku intact, she would have difficulty communicating with others of her kind, feeling pleasure, even loving someone. The headtails were part of her nervous system. And how much more in need of intimacy was she now, after becoming part of a close-knit Killick nest? Alima did have her reasons for wanting retribution then. Lumia was careful not to let that brief flood of pity start her thinking about what normality she, too, had lost.
"I'm sorry,"
Lumia said, and meant it.
"Now use that to remain focused, and to bide your time."
Alima looked at the courier shuttle, and seemed to be somewhere else entirely. Then she gazed down at the deck of the hangar, and began swaying a little as if listening to music. She raised one arm, the other hung limp, paralyzed by Luke Skywalker's lightsaber, and seemed to be going through the motions of a dance, turning slowly and with difficulty on her crippled foot. For a moment, Lumia thought it was one of her affectations. Then she realized that it was quite genuine. Alima was remembering her past, and what she could no longer do.
"We were a dancer,"
she said wistfully, but she was talking to herself.
"We loved to dance."
Lumia tried to think of all the things she had once loved to do, in the days before she entered Imperial service, and remembered none of them.
"Get a move on, Dancer," she said. "You can start by tracking the Anakin Solo."
The past didn't matter. Any of it. There was only the future. Sanvia Vitajuice Bar, Coruscant. Mara swirled the sediment of ground apple and dewflower juice around her glass and drank reluctantly as Kip Duron watched. He clearly had something to say that he didn't want to bring up in the Jedi Council chamber, or in front of Luke. And Ben still hadn't called in. The Anakin Solo had arrived back at Coruscant 2 days earlier, and there was no sign of Ben. Somehow she'd hoped he would have made his way to Jason, even if he wasn't feeling communicative. Just feeling that he was alive and unharmed wasn't enough. He was her little boy. She didn't care how many center points he could take out. This was her kid, and she couldn't stand it. Sometimes, when she looked at their lives through the eyes of a normal mother for a brief moment, she was horrified.
"If I didn't know better," Kip said, "I'd think you were avoiding me. The whole Jedi Council, in fact."
"Just busy. But you called me here for a reason, and it wasn't to boost my antioxidant levels."
"Well, maybe I'm just observant. But we have an out-of-control Jedi on the loose. Maybe the Council can help you with that. You know, combined efforts of the most experienced Jedi in the galaxy."
"What if I say Luke and I can handle it on our own?"
"Oh, family business."
"That, and the fact that not all the Council is on the same side, so we don't want to open a rift," Mara said.
"Been there, done that."
"Put yourself in Corin's position. Would you feel comfortable helping the chief of the GA's bully boy police after what he's been doing to Corellians and even his own parents? Better we clear up our own family mess."
"I'm surprised that Luke's tolerated Jason this long," Kip commented. "I wasn't entirely joking when I said we should make Jason a master. People tend to stop throwing rocks when they're inside the tent."
"I think now might not be the best time."
"Is Luke embarrassed? He's got problems within his own family?"
Mara almost blurted out that she'd stopped Luke from acting more than once, and now she bitterly regretted it. But that wasn't wholly true. "If I tell you that I've identified the root cause and I'm going to deal with it, will you back off?"
"I note the pronoun."
"Luke knows what I'm doing."
"Which is?"
"I'm going to kill Lumia."
"That removes the threat to Ben, but how does it deal with Jason?"
"She's infiltrated the GAG. I don't know who her insiders are, but we have to assume she can get at Jason, too. She might even influence him. She's got to go."
"What took you so long? The old cyborg must be running low on lube oil by now. You could take her any time."
"Luke tends to favor taking people alive and trying to talk them around." She couldn't bring herself to tell Kip that Luke had had a civilized chat with Lumia on the resort satellite. Touched her, even when she had her light whip in the other hand. He said her intentions felt peaceful. What was he thinking? "But she's not so decrepit. Believe me, I won't have an easy time of it."
"I'll help you if you want backup."
"I don't think I'll need it, but thanks."
Mara couldn't avoid the next question.
"What are the rest of the council members saying?"
"That you need to get a grip on this. We talk, you know."
"So we have a Jedi Council with the Skywalkers, and a Shadow Council meeting without them. Sounds like a fault line's forming."
"Well, you decided to go whack a Sith without consulting us."
Mara tried to see the double standard, spotted it easily, and ignored it.
"If I'd stood up in council and said, 'Hey, this lunatic is threatening my kid and keeps coming after my husband, so I'm going to take her head off,' you really think the other members would have nodded politely and voted on it? There are folks who think like Luke does, that the council doesn't condone assassinations, and that would make that fault line into a big rift faster than a greased pod racer."
Kip inspected the depths of his juice. He'd ordered something thick and opaquely orange that he didn't seem to be enjoying.
"So you're saving us from the moral dilemma?"
"If that's the way you want to see it."
The Vita Juice bar was quiet and smelled unappetizingly of wet, raw greenery like a flower shop. Maybe that was why it was so quiet. It made it a good place to meet. Nobody knew them here. Most of the customers seemed to be Ementis, probably because they could guarantee getting totally fruit-based nourishment here, prepared right in front of their six eyes. Ementis weren't big on trust, least of all in Coruscant's catering industry.
How much do I expect everyone to trust me?
Mara struggled with not telling her husband the entire truth while she confided in a friend. That was the problem. They were all friends, the whole Jedi Council. The Galactic Alliance Senate could tear chunks out of itself and not feel it, because it was thousands of rivals and enemies and even strangers. But the Council, they'd grown up together in many cases. They'd fought together. They were family, and not just because they were Jedi. Sil'Gal often cited the ancient rule of no attachments, but the Council was one big attachment in its own right. Mara realized she didn't like Dewflower, mused on ways to get around a light whip, and then flinched as her comlink chirped. She pulled it from her belt and raised it to see Ben's face.
"Mom, I just landed," he said.
"Ben? Are you at the military port?"
"No, the civilian one. Galactic City. Look, I'm sorry that—"
"Stay right where you are. Don't move, okay? I'll meet you at Arrivals 7B, okay?
Mom,
no arguing this time. Be there."
Mara snapped the comlink closed and grabbed her jacket.
"If you're thinking of telling Luke, Kip, give me a head start."
"Wouldn't dream of getting involved," he said, shrugging. "I'm glad Ben's okay. Just remember that kids like clear limits. He's still too young to set his own."
"Tried that," Mara said, and strode for the doors. "And he set his own just fine."
She worked her way through the crowds at the spaceport, sensing Ben's location. There were black-suited GAG personnel operating openly now, on foot patrol in the arrivals hall with blue-uniformed CSF officers. They were pretty conspicuous for secret police. Jason was adept at hearts and minds operations. He seemed to like to have his deterrence visible. It certainly seemed to reassure the public, despite the black visors that gave the GAG troopers the facelessly dispassionate air of battle droids. And suddenly there was Ben, sitting on the white marble pedestal of the 10-meter abstract statue of Prosperity that formed one of the supports for the central dome of the roof of the arrivals hall. Prosperity, progress, culture, and peace. Peace. Fat chance. Ben looked like any other 14-year-old kid, drumming his heels idly against the marble, staring intently at his datapad, and keying in something one-handed. A GAG trooper passed him. Ben looked up, nodded in acknowledgement, and got a respectful nod back. If Mara needed a reminder that Ben was anything but a normal teenager, that was it. He was a junior lieutenant. He commanded troopers like that. Her son helped run the secret police. But she'd learned the most silent and efficient ways to kill the Emperor's enemies by Ben's age, and Luke had been just 5 years older when he joined the rebellion.
What did we expect to give birth to? A librarian?
"Hi, Mom."
Ben slid the datapad into his jacket pocket. He had that tight-lipped look that went with bracing for a dressing down.
"You're mad at me, right?"
Mara paused, wanting at the same time to yell at him for terrifying her and to grab him in a ferocious hug. She settled for swallowing both reactions and ruffling his hair. He'd never live it down back at the barracks otherwise.
"You couldn't call us?" she said. "You couldn't even tell Jason where you were?"
Ben frowned slightly.
"I'm sorry. I was on a mission, and I didn't want to give away my location."
"We can talk about it later. Let's have lunch."
She gestured toward the exit.
"It's okay. Your dad will be happy just to see you back safe. No yelling.
I promise.
Ben slid off the pedestal in uncharacteristic silence, and they walked to the speeder platforms. Mara kept a careful eye on the crowd, not entirely sure if she'd recognize or even sense Lumia if she was around. Lumia might even send one of her minions, and she had people within the GAG. The biggest threat might be one of Ben's own troopers.
"What are you frightened of, Mom?"
Ben asked. Mara didn't take her eyes off the crowds around them. She scanned constantly, as she had been trained to do.
"Okay, you might as well know. Lumia is trying to kill you."
Ben gave a little grunt that might have been disbelief, and seemed to mull over the idea rather than show alarm.
"Because she's still got this vendetta with Dad?"
"Mainly because you killed her daughter."
Okay, I'll take her word for it."
Mara shielded Ben as he got into the speeder. It was always a vulnerable moment. She'd taken a few targets as they ducked into vehicles, caught off balance for a moment. The hatches closed with a sigh of air, and she turned to look at him closely.
"I mean it, Ben. She's dangerous and she's subtle. So until we neutralize her, you have to be on your guard. She's got connections within the GAG. It could be anyone."
"If she was going to have this spy of hers in the guard kill me, she'd have done it by now."
He slouched in the passenger's seat.
"But I'll be careful. Wow, this is getting messy. What with Jason on Fett's list for killing his daughter, and me killing Lumia's... I suppose that's what the job's about, isn't it? You collect enemies. Hey, the boys have got a bet going on when and how Fett's going to come after Jason."
Mara wasn't sure if Ben was making light of the threat for her sake, or just indulging in normal teenage dismissal. Fett was the least of her worries.
"And have you placed your bet?"
"Oh, Jason can take him. But it's kind of weird that Fett hasn't made a move. The longer he waits, the more people get freaked, I suppose."
"If Fett comes for Jason," she said, "let him handle it, okay?"
The speeder climbed into one of the automated sky lanes and headed for the rotunda zone. Ben gazed out of the side screen in silence.
"So can you tell me what this mission was?"
Mara asked. Ben did that 3-second pause that meant he was framing his words carefully.
"I had to bring back a prototype vessel. I wasn't in any more danger than I could comfortably handle."
That was a relief. It was just an errand. Although why Jason hadn't known about it baffled her.
"And you missed your birthday celebration."
"You know how folks say that you get to a point in life when birthdays don't matter? That's how it felt."
"Sweetheart, that's only when you get a lot older, not 14.
If anything could break Mara's heart, it was that. Ben's childhood had passed him by.
"Next year, I promise, we'll have a family get-together. Really mark the day."
"You think the war will be over by then?"
"If it's not, we'll still have a party. All of us."
"Uncle Han and Aunt Leia, too? Even after I tried to arrest Uncle Han?"
And that was the bizarre reality of a civil war. A teenage boy sent to detain his aunt and uncle, and then fretting over whether they'd attend his next birthday party. Mara sometimes tried to add up the days she'd lived that weren't about killing and warfare. And there were so very, very few. She wanted a different future for Ben.
"Yes, even after that,"
she said.
"Ben, does Jason know you're back?"
"Yeah."
He didn't volunteer anymore.
"It's okay. I report back for duty at 0800 tomorrow. I haven't gone AWOL."
"I'll have one last try, then. Ben, I worry about you. Your dad and I would really sleep a lot better if you left the GAG and came on missions with us."
Mara braced for incoming. But Ben thought visibly for a while, and when he spoke, his tone was soft and unsettlingly adult, unsettlingly old.
"Mom,
Have you ever had to do something you didn't want to do, but knew you had to?
Mara certainly had, so many times that she took it for granted. And at any given time, whether working for the Empire or the New Republic, or whatever the stang her paymaster called itself, she'd always thought it was right.
"Yes, sweetheart, I have," she said,
and knew she now had no moral high ground from which to look down upon her son, or anyone else for that matter.
"And the problem was that when I looked back, I found I'd done the wrong thing sometimes. But it'll be years before I'll know if what I'm doing now is right."
"You have to go with the best data you have at the time." It was a weary man's statement, not a boy's. Ben was a soldier. He was what she and Luke had made him. She'd wanted a Jedi son, and now she had one.
"Next year," she said, "next year we'll have that party, come what may."